Okay, time for a quiz. What organization holds the world's largest collection of meteorites, is one of the world's oldest astronomy research institutions, and operates a large telescope in Arizona that traces asteroids and discovers supernovae? Well, if you guess the Vatican, then you get the gold star. After all, we don't often think of the Catholic Church as a sponsor of scientific research. In fact, we most often think of religion and science as being incompatible, even at loggerheads. Well, at this time of year, when many people have religion on their minds, we'd like to take the opportunity to introduce you to someone who thinks quite differently about the relationship between faith and science. His name is Brother Guy Consolmagno, a Jesuit brother with a PhD in planetary science, who in fact works at the Vatican Observatory in Arizona as curator of the meteorite collection. I spoke to Brother Guy back in 2006, and here's that fascinating conversation once again. Brother Guy, welcome to Quirks and Quarks.
It's great to be here.
Okay, now as an astronomer and a Jesuit, I wonder, what is it that you with these two sets of eyes see when you look at the night skies?
I see exactly the same thing that anyone else sees. It's one of the joys of being an astronomer. You don't have to have a PhD to just have your socks knocked off by, say, the rings of Saturn.
But in terms of seeing, you know, creation as God might have done it, or see the physics of stellar evolution, how do you see it?
Well, it's really the same thing that a scientist does. You know, a scientist ultimately has a God, and it's the same God I've got. It's the God of truth. We want to know more than anything else what's really out there, what really happens when these things go on. And we know as a scientist that our explanations are never complete, otherwise we'd be out of a job. I also know as a person of faith that my understanding of God is never going to be complete. And both of these things go hand in hand. You talked about the uneasy relationship between science and religion, but it's a sibling rivalry. They really have so much in common. They have so much desire to understand and grasp these things that are always just a little bit outside of our grasp, that sometimes they do get into arguments, but they're arguments within the family.
Ah, so you don't see them as competing, you see them as just trying to get at the same thing from different directions.
At best, they're not competing. Of course, we all know siblings sometimes do compete.
Well, tell me how you came to be both an astronomer and a Jesuit.
Comes from my background. I was born in Detroit and came from a family that my parents are both very religious, but at the same time also very well educated. Both had college degrees. And I grew up during the era of Sputnik. You know, I started kindergarten when Sputnik started orbiting. How could you not be fascinated by space and by astronomy at that time? But I went to a Jesuit high school in Detroit and got to know the Jesuits there, got to be very impressed with how they were able to live in the world without having the world sort of capture them. And that's something that always stuck with me. I thought about being a Jesuit when I first went to college, and it didn't feel right then. Instead, I went to MIT. I joke the reason I went to MIT is because it had pinball machines and the world's best science fiction collection. But eventually, after 15 years of being a scientist and wondering, you know, why am I doing this when people are starving in the world? I first had a couple of years in the Peace Corps. I went to Africa thinking I would help starving people rather than do astronomy, and the first thing they asked me to do was teach them astronomy, which made me realize that there's this important human dimension to doing astronomy. This is one of the things that makes us more than just well-fed cows, that anyone can be fascinated by the stars and want to know what's out there and how did they get that way. To deny that to a poor person just because they're poor denies them their humanity.
I think I read about you saying that you didn't have any trouble with the poverty, the chastity, and the
obedience.
The obedience.
Because I'd already lived that life as a scientist, all of them. You know, sadly, when I was at MIT, the male-female ratio was 9-1. It's a bit different now.
Ah, really? Well, how difficult was it for you to reconcile your science and your religion?
It's never been a problem. The real problem for me has been to try to understand why people have that problem, because the two are so obviously congruent to me. And even when you read the history of science, you realize that science came out of the church. What are the assumptions that every scientist makes? That the universe is for real, and I'm not just a butterfly dreaming that I'm a scientist. That the universe makes sense, where a lot of other cultures thought it was chaos. And that studying the universe is a worthwhile thing to do. You know, if your religion says that you should meditate yourself out of this corrupting physical plane, you're not going to do physical sciences. But the sciences have been supported among those cultures, Islam, Judaism, and Christianity, that believe that the universe was made deliberately by God, who looked at it and said, this is good. So there's really a religious basis behind the idea that doing science just for its own sake is something that grown men ought to be doing, and grown women nowadays too.
Well, obviously, though, this isn't the case for everyone. Why do you think so many people have problems with that reconciliation between religion and science?
A lot of people stopped learning about science when they were maybe 10 or 11 years old, and so they don't really understand what science is. They think it's just a bunch of facts in a book. Unfortunately, a lot of people also stopped learning about religion when they were that age. And when you're told by the culture that you have to choose between one or the other, then people feel that they have to make their claim by saying, I'm truly religious and I won't bother believing in that Big Bang stuff, or I'm truly a scientist and I won't bother believing in that God stuff. When in fact, the two really are trying to get at the same idea. What is truth? Where did it come from? Not only why is there something instead of nothing, which is a religious question, but it's a religious question that was posed by Leibniz, who is a scientist.
Let's take an example here. There are those who would point to a particular kind of science, say the physics that gives us a sort of a predictable universe, and you have everything all figured out, and there's no room for the supernatural. That's not leaving any room for God. How do you understand that kind of conflict?
Well, the physical description that you're describing is a pretty good description of the Newtonian universe. And according to Newton's laws, if you know the exact position of everything and the exact forces acting on them, then you can come up with an exact answer. And in the last 100 years, we learned that the very fundamental assumptions are false. There is no such thing as an exact position. There's no such thing as an exact formulation of the force. I'm not saying that quantum uncertainty is where you find God, but I am saying that we know Newtonian physics fails when you get to the realm of quantum uncertainty. Newtonian physics also fails when it comes to the issue of the free will of the human soul. And I'm not saying that the two are equal, but just that both of them are examples where Newtonian physics is incomplete. And you know, that's all right, because I don't have to know either of those things in order to build a bridge that will stay up. One of the joys of Newtonian physics is that we know very well where it fails, so we know the places where we can be secure in it.
Can God break physical laws in answer to a prayer, for example?
I think he can, and I think he doesn't. It's the wonderful answer, the wonderful way around all of the really nasty religious questions that people have struggled with for a long time. Why is there evil? Why does God allow tsunamis and earthquakes and hurricanes to occur? God has set up a universe by rules, and he has agreed to follow the rules. God could do it lots of other ways. The fact that God decided to do it this way is interesting because it tells us something about God's personality. And, you know, in understanding the rules of the universe, one of the fascinating things is that beauty and elegance are really good pointers to which scientific theory is most likely to be fruitful and worth following. That's telling you something about God's personality. So how is it possible that God does answer prayers in a universe that he's already set up the rules? Mm-hmm. One of the rules of the universe is free will. And a friend of mine once put it this way, that God acts in the universe through the free will people that he has put here, namely through us.
How do you understand those whose faith includes a literal understanding of the Bible and they reject things like the Big Bang, geology, even biology?
I have great respect for people who have that much faith. They obviously don't understand what science is trying to do. They're rejecting something that isn't necessary to reject. I'm reminded of the story of Abraham. Abraham in the Bible is told or feels that he's compelled to sacrifice his son. And he takes Isaac up to the mountain. But before he plunges in the knife, he hears a message from God. No, don't do that. Spare the child. And I always think they're, you know, the arch-conservatives are the ones who are willing to make that sacrifice, and the liberals would never even consent to it. But if you're too much of an arch-conservative, you don't hear the voice of God saying, spare the child. They're willing to make this sacrifice, but it's a sacrifice like the sacrifice of Abraham that I don't believe God wants us to make. That God has given us the brains to understand this universe, and the eyes and the ears and the tongue to taste and sense it, because he wants this to be a way for us to experience his creation and ultimately to experience him.
Now, you are a Vatican astronomer, and I think most people don't even know that the Vatican has an astronomy, an observatory, and would find that a conflict in terms here. What Vatican science, what effect do you think science has had on religion?
Oh, it's had a tremendous effect. And, you know, one of the reasons the Vatican has an observatory is precisely so that people will be shaken out of their complacent, oh, I think I understand how this all works. You go, really? They have an observatory? Maybe all the other things I assumed about astronomy and religion might be a little shaky, too. What religion has done for science is to give scientists a reason to study. What science has done for religion is to cure it from superstition, to cure it from a too narrow view of the world. You know, back when Genesis was written, and they took the best science of its day, which was Babylonian science, and the world was flat, and there was a dome over the world, and waters above and below the dome. People said, when they were writing Genesis, God made this, and God is bigger than as far as you can see to the farthest mountain, and as high as you can see up into the sky, and as deep as you can see into the earth. Bigger than that is God. And that was as big a God as they could imagine. Now, 3,000 years later, we know that we're in a universe of 13.7 billion light years dimension that we can see, not to mention the stuff beyond that we can't see, not to mention the possibility of multiverses beyond that. And to say God is bigger than that gives you a sense of God's infinity that the Babylonians couldn't possibly have grasped.
You're a strong defender of the Catholic Church's involvement in science. Tell me about that.
Well, the church has always been involved in science, and the church ought to be involved in science because science comes out of the belief in a God who so loved the world that he gave his son. Notice the phrase doesn't say God loved nice ideas or God loved good people. God loved the world. Part of that means that we're expected to love the world, and so the ecology movement has a great basis in that. Part of it also is to recognize that we're part of the world. And it was G.K. Chesterton 100 years ago that insisted Christianity gave our culture the permission to solve physical problems by physical means. And so that means that we do doctoring with whether it's, you know, manipulation of people's backs or giving them pills, whatever. We do physical means to try to cure physical ailments rather than just praying and hoping that God will take care of it. All of that comes out of a religious sense. And people sometimes forget, until the middle of the 19th century, most scientists were clergymen. I mean, who else had the free time and the education to go out and, you know, gathering leaves and try to make sense out of one kind of tree over another? I've seen on your website pictures of you getting honorary degrees, and what strikes me is the robes look an awful lot like priest's robes. Why do you think? Because in the tradition of the medieval university, it was priests and brothers and monks who were doing the teaching.
Well, how do you think that science and religion may change each other in the future?
I think it's already happening, and I think it's happening right now. I think, first of all, both in the last 100 years have gotten a lot more humble. We no longer have the triumphalistic church of pre-Vatican II or the 19th century, where religion, we had it all solved and no one else need apply. We've also had a breakdown of the triumphalistic idea that progress was always going to be bigger and better, when we discovered that some of the bigger and betters we get are bigger and better machine guns and atomic bombs and pollution spills. So in both cases, I think the surety and the arrogance has been broken down. The second thing that I think allows science and religion to interact more is that people are more and more unafraid to take part in it. It's an interesting thing. I was a scientist 15 years before I became a Jesuit, and when I became a Jesuit, I expected maybe I'd get some opposition from my friends. It was just the opposite. Half of the scientists who I ran into, people I knew before, came up to me and said, oh, that's great, you belong to a church. Let me tell you about the church I belong to. It turns out that the proportion of scientists who are religious believers is pretty much parallel the proportion you'd find in the general population, and probably much higher than you'd find in, say, English literature departments or at the CBC.
You do write about the, in terms of the future, our possible contact with alien civilizations and how that may influence our concept of God and our place in the universe. Tell me about that.
Well, as I warned you, I went to MIT because of the science fiction collection. I love science fiction. I love reading the stuff. And I'm fascinated because it's a way of doing thought experiments, playing what-ifs. One of the authors who's done a lot of this is Robert Sawyer, a great Canadian author. Mm-hmm. And I've chatted with him at great length. We obviously don't see eye to eye in religion, but we do see eye to eye in science fiction, and we have a lot of fun chatting about these things. You know, if you want to understand what it is to be human, one of the questions you can ask is, human as compared to what? And that's what science fiction does. It says, human as compared to a sentient computer, human as compared to a Vulcan. All of these stories really are not about computers or Vulcans. They're stories about human beings. And there are ways that we can help explore what it means to be human. I think that's a very religious question, and I think it's also a question that comes directly out of our science and our recognizing of all the scientific possibilities.
Well, Brother Guy, based on what you've just told me, I really do believe that you see something slightly different than I do when you look at the night sky.
Oh, it's only because the night sky in Toronto is too light polluted. You have to get out in the desert.
Thank you very much for taking the time to talk to us.
Thanks for having me. Talk to you later.
Brother Guy Consolmagno is a Jesuit, a planetary scientist, and the curator of the meteorite collection at the Vatican Observatory in Arizona. And before we go, I want to give a shout-out to listeners in Nova Scotia. This year's annual Quirks Question Roadshow is returning to Halifax, where we held our first roadshow a dozen years ago. And that means we need your science questions. If we choose yours for the show, then you'll have a chance to come to the recording in late May to ask the question directly to the scientist with the answer. But first, we need the questions. Lots of them. Simply go to our webpage at cbc.ca/quirks and click on the Contact Us link. Come on, Halifax, we're counting on you. And that's it for this week's edition of Quirks and Quarks. Next week, controlling computers with your mind. If you'd like to get in touch with us, you can write to Quirks and Quarks, P.O. Box 500, Station A, Toronto, Ontario, M5W1E6. Our email is quirks@cbc.ca. And to get to our webpage, just go to cbc.ca/quirks, where you can subscribe to our podcast, listen to our audio archives, follow us on Twitter and Facebook at CBC Quirks, and read our latest blog. Quirks and Quarks is produced by Jim Hanman, Jim Lebbins, and Mark Crawley, with technical help from Nima Shams. I'm Bob McDonald. Thanks for listening.